Okay, we were talking about the communication.
Yeah, so it took actually 2 months before we were able to call them by telephone in our district headquarters.
Okay.
And we had the radio communication, but it was not sufficient, so we were not able to communicate with our district headquarters from the station. So I had a visit. I paid a visit in the district headquarters every day, every morning. That's the first after the morning briefing. I had to go to the district headquarters just to have a meeting with the district commander.
Right. Okay.
And it was the same for all other stations. So we, mm-hmm. we gathered there twice or three times a week.
Mm-hmm. Now you talked about the one of the major problems seems to be the plainclothes civilian operations that were going on. Were the reports that you made, did they ever have any effect on changing that?
They were able to put pressure on SWAPO.
Okay, then yeah. who was putting the pressure on?
You know the system is that when I got a report from the police officers, the reports goes to the district commander, and the district commander sent it to the police commissioner who was located in Winter.
In Winter, okay.
And then you can bring it up on, you can try to sort it out on that level, or you have to bring it up on the SOSG's level.
Okay, okay.
Because you have a certain level.
Okay, so if you could actually go to Ahtisaari, that if it needed to go to that level, it could go to Matti Ahtisaari,
yeah,
who was this
through the commission.
Special representative.
Right.
And then would he then discuss it with the Administrator General, Luis Pienaar?
Then you have to go to the local authorities and find the right level. And
of the police. And
the message will come back to the local authorities, to the police. And that's the same as
okay. All right. So that the report would make its way, if you weren't getting any action, the report could get its way all the way to Ahtisaari, and then they would put some pressure on the police, the SWAPO headquarters,
yeah,
in Windhoek, and then the orders could come back down then to the local police.
That's
so
great.
Okay, so what kind
but
of
but it takes time.
But it takes time. So you did see some change during the period that you were there?
Yeah. Yes, we did. But it took some time. But they were very active before the election, because we were also responsible for to organize the polling stations.
The polling stations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So we had a cooperation with the civilian part of the operation, who was also responsible for the election.
Okay.
So we located the polling stations and made some preparation for in the area with the local authorities. And we had a close cooperation with the civilian part.
Okay.
So when we deployed before the election, we were mixed on the polling station with three, four civilian police officers, and then the rest of the team consisting of civilians. We saw some changes because. During this, when they held all the political rallies, they were very active, and they visited the villages during the night time, and also. But coming up to the election, it was more calm.
Uh huh. Oh, right before the election,
yeah.
It got calmer.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Now,
They were still there. Yeah.
In Windhoek. In the weeks coming up to the election, there were some assassinations that took place, and other kind of, you know, more violent intimidation. Mm. Did any of that go on up in the north?
No.
No.
No. It was, you know, it was calm and quiet in that area. It was actually.
It actually was, yeah. Huh. Oh, interesting. Now, did you feel that in the long run it was important for the police to have peacekeeping troops as a backup? I mean, would you recommend that that be the case in police operations?
Yeah, it's very important, and I can't see that you will see any operations where the police unit is allowed in the area. Because that was a problem in Haiti.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When the military pulled out, they needed a backup force, and they brought in the gendarmes from Argentina. So they are the backup force.
Yeah. Okay.
And
okay.
Going to former Yugoslavia and Bosnia Herzegovina, when we had this weapon control program, it was conducted by the police. By the civilian police, mm-hmm. but you will always find a NATO troop supporting them as the backup security.
Mm-hmm.
But the only place we do not have any backup was the last part of the operation in Eastern Slavonia. But it's very important. Mm-hmm. It's very important to have a backup force as a security.
Okay, and then what level of force? Does this backup force need to have? I mean, I'm getting very technical and specific here, but you know, what kind of should they be armed, and at what level should they be armed to deter problems?
Yeah, it's a technical question.
Yeah.
Our backup force was a platoon.
Okay.
Yeah, and they were armed with sidearms and long arms.
Mm-hmm.
So they had some armed vehicles.
They had some armed vehicles, yeah. Did they have armored personnel carriers?
Yeah, they had a few.
I mean, now we're talking about Namibia.
In Namibia,
they did. Uh-huh.
They did.
Uh-huh. And that. Was more effective. I mean, it did make. What I'm wondering is, did the appearance of that level of force tend to deter people trying to obstruct your goals?
We had in that area. It was sufficient.
Okay.
It was sufficient.
It was sufficient.
But it depends on the level of the problems you will see in an area.
Okay.
What you need.
What you need depends.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Like for example, if the Southwest African police or the level of military in some other kind of situation were that they were more heavily armed, would your backup need to be equally armed?
In the operations when you have a mandate linked up to chapter 6.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You will not find any troops heavily armed. But coming up to chapter 7,
mm-hmm.
they will be sufficient armed as you can see NATO troops are.
Yeah, right.
But going back to UNIFIL, where I took part as a military officer,
mm-hmm.
we had these armed I'll say it again.
The armored personnel carriers?
Yes.
Yeah.
APCs. That was APCs. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was that's the heaviest we have.
Yeah.
in a UN operation.
Okay. Now, I've been asking you kind of a lot of questions that really relate to the whole idea of coercion, you know, trying to coerce them into behaving properly. Were there any tools that you had that were incentives, in other words, any way that you could encourage them by benefits that you might give them to behave properly? Was there anything like that that was that you as a police officer could hand out to people?
No.
It wasn't. Are there any kinds of tools like that that might be available to police?
Going back from Namibia and up to Bosnia, for instance.
Yes.
You can see we are building up a brand new police force there. Mm-hmm. Or that means we decreased the number from 40,000. Down to 12,000 police officers. That's the level they should be on in Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republika Srpska,
mm-hmm.
they were not so cooperative in the very beginning. I think it's going much better now. But on the other side, when you have the Croats and the Muslims,
mm-hmm.
They were cooperative and we could start the work, it was working quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And the benefit was that they were provided with new vehicles, and new uniforms,
mm-hmm.
Armed with sufficient pistols and so on. So everything was new. And from the other side, it was nothing happened because they didn't like to see us there, and then they refused to start to decrease the number of police officers. So you could see a huge difference between when you cross the line from the western part of Bosnia and Herzegovina to the eastern part of Republika Srpska.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like going from day to night.
Okay. So in a sense, because they were cooperating with you, then you could give them the benefit of new equipment. And
because that was the aim, to build up a new police force,
yeah.
and to give them a new design.
Right. No, so in Namibia, that wasn't what was going on, because you were preparing for an election that was actually going to change the government, and then that would be the responsibility of the new government to reform the police. So you weren't really involved in reforming the police. You were just trying to keep them more or less from interfering with the elections and the whole process.
Yeah.
So it was a different kind of goal that you were involved in. Well, I mean, the other thing that I wanted to ask you is from my interviews that I did at UNIFIL, one of the things that they spoke about quite a bit was that the off-duty UN peacekeepers were very involved in the community and building all kinds of things within the villages and that kind of thing, and developing a kind of rapport with the local people. And they felt that actually enhanced their ability to function as UN peacekeepers, because they really had a good relationship with local people. So in Namibia, did you find that the police monitors got involved in any way in the community, that in some way enhanced your relationship with the local people?
I'm not sure in other parts, in other areas, but in Anhana area and also in Mariental area, where I was station mm-hmm. commander in the second part, we were not, because we had a kind of a rotation system.
Okay.
And we were mainly living in camps, coming out to all the way up north, in Anhana, Oshakati, and
okay.
Caprivi. It was so we. we didn't have the possibility to get involved so close to the civilian population. Unfortunately.
Because you were doing patrols and you were kind of really constantly moving.
Right, and we spent only 1 year there. And since we had a rotation system, it was from 3 to 6 months in each station, so that's why you had to move around. Mm-hmm. But in Namibia, in UNIFIL in South Lebanon, where the Norwegians are, we have been there since 78.
Right. Okay, so we left 21 years.
Yeah, it was quite different.
Right. Yeah.
And also, since we were living in camps, we had no close connection to the civilian population. Mm-hmm. But going back to Bosnia and the operations going on in former Yugoslavia, mm-hmm. it's different because we are deployed as individuals, and we had to find our own accommodation because we are provided with this MSA from the UN.
You provided with
the MSA. That's a monthly subsistence allowance.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you had to find your own accommodation, and you had to go out among the civilians.
Oh,
and
I see.
Do you have a room for me, or rent your house, or apartment, and so on?
Yeah.
So in that way, you will have a much more closer cooperation, and you will learn to know the locals in another way than we did in Namibia.
I see. Okay. Now, you had mentioned in the beginning that you had water tanks, trucks that were bringing water in, and this was really a valued commodity to have water. So in the beginning, the local population was coming in and getting water from your trucks.
Yeah. It took about 2 hours to empty the water tank, and then you had to wait for another 2 days
before you would get any more water.
So we tried to avoid them. We tried to refuse them to enter the camp, and we succeeded in the end when we got the fence.
Yeah, because you needed the water.
We did, and we were 58 officers there, mm-hmm. so it was quite a problem. It was a problem, and when we got the fence and we were able to keep them outside the camp, you could feel the atmosphere was not so good.
Oh, okay.
But they understood the problem after a while. So, mm-hmm. but it was a problem because it was only a few water holes in that area.
Yeah.
And in the end, before you had the rain season, all the water holes are almost empty. So, had a problem. And the water pipe from Ushakati Udangwa was broke down, so they were not supplied by water either. It was fixed after a while, but it took quite a while before they were supplied with water.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So they were very eager to get hold of the water we had.
Did you find though that you had we were talking earlier about communications in general, but did you find that you had enough information to do your job properly, that you were getting enough information either from headquarters or about what was going on in your region of responsibility?
We had a mandate, mm-hmm. and we had also a note for the guardians, for police officers and military observers. That means that's our Bible.
Mm, yeah, okay.
But enough information, no. But everything was new. This was the first time the civilian police was brought into to a peacekeeping operation, mm-hmm. in that huge number.
Yeah.
We had a few times before, we had some experience from Cyprus, and also we had a small unit taking part in the conflict in Congo in 1964.
Right.
But no. they were more linked up to the military police, so they had no experience, and they didn't take in New York. They do not have any. They didn't have any lesson learned unit at that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the experience from Congo and from Cyprus was not sufficient enough. And that's why we have to find our own ways how to deal with the problems.
Okay.
We have a mandate and we have some guidelines, but it was more or less on an individual basis you were running the station. And that's why you could see when you came to a station where you had a Swedish station commander, you had a Swedish system, and Irish station commander, you find an Irish system. Mm. And if you came to a station with a station commander from Nigeria, he had his own system.
Okay.
So it was built up on individual basis.
Okay. Now, did the local population, after they understood that you were police, did they expect you to carry out police activities? Did they come to you and ask you to intervene in different cases? Or did they understand that you were just monitoring?
And they understood that we were just monitoring, and we explained our task to them. Mm-hmm. So if they come to complain about an intimidation or something like that,
mm-hmm.
we sat down and we wrote the report.
Mm-hmm.
But then we took the report and the person and brought it over to the Swapo station and said that, hey, listen, this person, he has complained about this case.
Oh,
please start the investigation. And we were also monitoring not only on the Swapo on patrol, but we were also monitoring the work they did in the stations. And one person sitting in the Swapo station.
Oh, you did?
24 hours a day.
Oh,
and his responsibility was to follow up and see whether they did what they were supposed to do or they didn't. I mean, if one civilian came and were supposed to complain about an intimidation,
mm-hmm.
and if he was refused, okay, we had to make a report. And if they took his statement, the civilian or our police officer, he will sit next to them and see how we did it. And he will also follow up all the cases because we were reviewing their all the cases they had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if we found that this the investigation in this case is not sufficient, you have to do it once more.
I see. Okay.
And if they didn't, okay, we wrote the report and sent it up through the system.
Okay. So ultimately, if you were not getting cooperation from their police station that you were monitoring, then that could be taken to a higher level of authority, say, for example, in Windhoek.
Right.
Now, did you ever hear of, I know you didn't personally witness it, but did you ever hear of some kind of leverage being put on Windhoek from South Africa, for example, or?
No.
You didn't know whether there was leverage?
I don't know.
But but you did find that there would be some kind of effect on what you were doing, and that things would get better, that they would.
Oh yeah, especially when we had all the civilians I was talking about on the trucks during the nighttime.
Okay.
It was we complained about them and it was brought up on a high level by the district commander.
Okay.
And then
mm-hmm.
the result was that all this cohort soldiers, they were confined to bases. So we had two bases in.
Okay. So you suspected that some of these so-called civilians who were going out at night probably were the Kofut.
Could be.
Could have been at some point. But then later they were confined to base.
Mm.
And then did these night visits somewhat diminish?
They decreased.
They did decrease.
Yeah.
They weren't eliminated.
Yeah. We tried to follow them, but it was not able. We were not able to do so in the darkness.
Yeah.
Because it was we had also the security risk.
Right. And now at one point, and I can't remember exactly when this happened, but at one point one of the UN headquarters out in that area was bombed, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was before my time.
But it was before your time.
Yeah, it was in the early stage.
In the early stages,
yeah.
Did you personally feel safe where you were?
I feel safe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did.
You did.
Yeah, I did. I was walking alone because every night I used to run for an hour and a half, and I was alone in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt safe.
You felt safe, yeah. What did you? I mean, just on a personal level, just a few questions. I mean, what about the health conditions there? Did anyone have any major health problems, malaria or other kinds of?
I know that one or two Swedish officers got malaria, but because we were in all the way up north, you are in the red zone for, mm-hmm. for malaria.
Mm-hmm.
But coming further south to Windhoek, it's like here.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So if you're in the Windhoek area, you don't have to take anti-malaria. Yeah.
All the way.
Did you take anti-malarials?
Yes,
and
would
you give vaccinations and so forth before you got there?
We had all kind of vaccinations and we mm-hmm. we took anti-malaria.
Were there any problems in that area with wild animals? I mean, the lions or any kind of dangers like that?
Not a single one.
Not a single
I never
one.
Saw. I asked, where are the animals? And they said, all the animals are killed.
Okay.
Because of the war. So you had to go to...
the parks, yeah.
The parks,
like
Itasha.
Yeah. So they weren't
I saw a few snakes.
you saw a few snakes.
Yeah.
Are there poisonous snakes there?
Oh, yeah. They are there. Yeah.
But in general, you felt pretty safe.
I did.
Yeah. And now the elections took place, and the days leading up to the elections, was it fairly calm?
At least in my district, it was calm.
Yeah.
And we didn't have any problems at all during the election period, because we had in all the polling stations we had the officers there. Living in the station 24 hours a day, so they were responsible for the security of the station and also the ballot boxes.
Okay.
Because
the
election took place over 2, 3, 4 days.
That's right. Yeah.
So my policy was to visit at least all the polling stations once or maybe twice during the election period.
Okay. To visit each polling station
right.
in your district.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And the ballot boxes were brought back by helicopter to Inhana. So we had them gathered in the school.
Okay, in the school.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
And the school was secured by police officers, local police officers, civilian police officers, and also by.
The peacekeeping.
Yeah.
Now, actually, were you as police officers armed, or were you completely unarmed?
We were supposed to be armed, but we confiscated all the weapons, so we were unarmed.
Why did you decide to do that?
Because, in my opinion, and from my experience, is that when we are, that's a part of our life insurance. To be unarmed.
What do you mean?
Because when the military observers, they have the same policy. You will never find an armed military observer.
Okay.
Because first of all, what we are carrying, the arms we are carrying is only a pistol or a revolver.
Right.
And the parties, they have all kinds of weapons, automatic weapons. They mm-hmm. have. You name it. So as long as they know that we are unarmed, I mean, if a person is has a bad behavior, to kill an unarmed person, I mean, they have a kind of a fence they have to break through. But if they know that the person is armed, okay, then they have more or less justified, and that would be quite another behavior from the parties.
Okay, so you felt safer not being armed?
Right.
Okay. And that's so it, when you say life insurance, you mean just that you're safer. You don't mean like a life insurance policy that you assign. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you wear bulletproof vests?
We brought bulletproof vests.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So we are always bringing, and it was in our vehicles, but we didn't carry them.
You didn't really wear them.
No.
It's hot.
It's hot.
Yeah.
So if we the only place I used my bulletproof vest was in Sarajevo, but I never used it in Namibia.
You didn't use it.
It was in my car, but I didn't use it.
Okay.
But you mentioned armed or not armed. It has been a quite hard discussion going on in UN.
Okay.
And also because it was brought up in 1996 when you opened the operation in IPTF in Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Mm-hmm.
Just the Americans they want to carry arms.
Right.
So we convinced them that this is a part of our life insurance, and
mm-hmm.
and actually they accepted after a while. But now we have a new operation coming up in Kosovo, and unfortunately the police officers will be armed.
Will be.
And they will have executive power. And also
by executive power, what do you mean by that?
They will do normal police.
Oh, okay. So that they can make arrests, they can do investigations.
Right. And the other place we have armed police officers is in Haiti.
In Haiti, yeah. Okay.
But that's they have another mandate.
Yeah. Now, in Namibia, did you ever feel frustrated that in fact you couldn't make an arrest, or that you couldn't do your own investigation or whatever?
No, I didn't, because we are not supposed to do any arrest. This is a part of the local police force.
Okay.
Because we are monitors.
Yeah.
We are monitoring them, but we have no executive power.
Right. I was just probing.
Yeah.
Now, did you feel that the Southwest African police were really most of their activity had to do with preventing crime, or was there most of their activity really politically motivated?
In the part in Hana,
mm-hmm.
Preventing crime. Yes, they did, but. Part was politically motivated,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Yeah. Particularly these
that my
night patrols.
Privates.
Yeah.
And
the night patrol
right.
type of thing.
Yeah.
Was that their primary motive?
Yeah, because we could never prove that it was a part of Kofod, or it was a part of the civilian police
mm-hmm.
doing all those patrols during that time, but. The reports we got, or the statement we got from the local population, was quite clear.
Describe the Kofut, because I've heard a little bit about them. I mean, who were they? What were they? What were they supposed to do?
They were recruited among the local population.
Yeah.
And they were. Experts just to follow or in field work.
Field work, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So when they built up the military.
Hello. I think that we'll just finish for now. Perhaps.